In the following podcast from 9.com.au, we are not suggesting Kate and Jerry McCann were responsible for what happened to Maddie or are lying. Her case is simply a mystery, but they were considered suspects by the Portuguese police, and we examine why that was and why the questions about what happened to Maddie haven't gone away.
We're just hearing that a search is underway for a three-year-old British girl who's gone missing in the Algarve area of Portugal.
Someone's taken her. Madeline's gone.
Words cannot describe the anguish and despair that we are feeling as the parents of our beautiful daughter, Madeline.
Parents of Madeline McCann are now considered formal suspects by the Portuguese police authorities.
We have played no part in the disappearance of our lovely daughter, Madeline.
There are days when you just want to get under the duvet or just want to be in a coma till it's over, just to relieve the pain and get some peace, but you can't.
What happened to Madeline McCann? If you type that question into Google, you'll get back 248,000 results. An ocean of stories, facts, theories, speculation. But what you won't find is the answer to that unsolved riddle. What happened to Madeline McCann? I put that question to pretty much everyone I interviewed for this podcast. And so it was when I spoke to Sonia Poulton, a British journalist who has followed this case since day one, when Maddie vanished in Portugal on May 3, 2007. Sonia's written for the Daily Mail, the Daily Express, and a bunch of other UK newspapers.
In terms of what has happened to Madeline McCann, I have to be really, really careful here, Mark. I don't need to tell you that I'm pausing because I'm really, not only am I really reluctant to say, I'll be very, very clear. I don't know what's happened to Madeline McCann, okay? I have suspicions about what I think has happened to Madeline McCann. What I do, absolutely, 100%, categorically feel certain, based on spending 2 years reading the police files. Some people get over them in a matter of months. I've taken 2 years to read them. I've read every spit and cough of those police files. And what is quite clear to me is that the idea, the notion that Madeline McCann was abducted can only exist when people are not prepared to look into the full story. I do not believe Madeline McCann was abducted. Something else happened to her. What is still a massive question mark?
My name is Mark Salnokonoko, and I'm a reporter for 9.com.au, and this is a podcast called Maddie. The Maddie podcast series explores what many believe is the well-known story of Madeline McCann's disappearance. But this is an investigation of the evidence that could make you question everything you thought you knew about the case. On the night of October 15, 2013, 6 years after Maddie vanished, there was a sudden and seismic development in the case. The Jane Tanner sighting, for so long a controversial piece of evidence, was officially discounted. Her report of maybe seeing the man who stole Maddie on the night she disappeared was ruled out. Now, police concluded that the man she reported seeing was just a holidaymaker, carrying his child back from a night crash at the resort where the McCanns and the Tapas 7 were staying. Instead, there was a new sighting to focus on, and it totally blew open police thinking on the case. Did it hold the key to the Maddie mystery? Except this sighting, well, it wasn't a new sighting. The Smith sighting, as it became known, hinged on three witness statements given to police by an Irish family way back in May 2007. Like the McCanns and their friends, the Smiths, a group of four adults and five children from Drogheda, Ireland, were holidaying in the town of Praia da Luz. On the night of May 3, at about 10 p.m, the large Smith family were walking home after eating dinner in one of the town's restaurants. On the quiet streets, the Smiths crossed paths with a white man carrying a motionless, possibly sleeping, small blonde girl in his arms. He was coming at them from the north, where the Ocean Club Resort is located, about 270 meters away. In dim light, the man was carrying the child towards the beach, which was just 150 meters further up the road. You're about to hear Detective Chief Inspector Andy Redwood of London Metropolitan Police describe the man the Smiths saw that night. Now, the reason DCI Redwood is talking about this is because by 2013, when the Smith sighting rocketed to prominence, the London Met had begun to investigate the Maddie case. The Portuguese investigation, it was shelved in 2008, so I'm jumping ahead of things a little bit here, but we need to start thinking about the Smith sighting right now. So here's DCI Redwood on BBC's Crime Watch.
Well, at 10 p.m, we can see a man walking down towards the sea, a white man in his 30s with brown hair, and in his arms is a child, 3 to 4 years of age, blonde hair, wearing pyjamas, very close description to that of Madeleine McCann.
Then, on TV screens right across Britain, Crime Watch flashed up two e-fits of this man, which had been drawn up based on interviews with the Smith family. Both e-fits look quite similar to each other. A white man with short brown hair, similar darkish eyes. The jawline square on one, it was narrower on the other.
Two e-fits that have never been in the public domain of this one individual. Really important for us to understand who he is.
So who had the Smith seen and identified? Who was the man on the dark street that night, carrying a child that looked a lot like Maddie? Scotland Yard was suddenly calling this sighting vitally significant, which raised the question, given that the Smiths gave their statements to Portuguese police 6 years earlier, why were the public only seeing these vitally significant e-fits now? To get a good look at both of the Smith e-fits, head to 9.com.au/Maddie. This development, the Smith sighting, well, it altered 6 years of thinking on the case, particularly around the timeline of a potential abduction. From 2007, Portuguese and British police presumed any abduction probably took place around 9:15 p.m., the time of Jane Tanner's reported sighting. But through the prism of the Smith sighting, it now seemed much more likely that Madeleine could have been moved 45 minutes after Jane Tanner first thought. But moved by who and for what reason? Was it an abduction, or was somebody hiding her? Was somebody disposing of a dead body? The Smiths' witness statements had initially not been given much significance. The thinking on the Smith sighting was wrong time, wrong place. If an abductor took Maddie at 9:15 p.m, what on earth was he still doing wandering around a small town with the girl in his arms 45 minutes later at 10 p.m. when the Smith sighting occurred? It made no sense.
What makes the Smith sighting very interesting is that Jane Tanner is a friend. And the Smith sighting is a bunch of people that have no clue who the McCanns are. I mean, these are not their friends. And there's a whole bunch of people, not one person, saying that they saw somebody taking a child.
Pat Brown, the US criminal profiler, has told me on a number of occasions that she thinks the Smith sighting could be the key to solving the entire Maddie case.
I believe the Smith sighting occurred. I believe they saw a man carrying a little girl down that road, which is toward the beach. Nobody has ever come forward to say they are the man of the Smith sighting.
So here's a pretty big question. How and why did the two e-fits that were showcased on BBC's Crime Watch in October 2013 come into the public domain, years after they were drawn up in 2008? The answer is complex, fascinating, and punctuated with twists and turns. Somewhat unusually, it turned out the two e-fits had not been produced by police. Instead, the e-fits were created by a team of private investigators who had been hired by Kate and Jerry McCann. After months of work, the investigators, who were working under the codename Operation Omega, they compiled an intelligence dossier for the McCann team, including the two e-fits. That report, which was handed to the McCanns in 2008, also reportedly contained criticism about the Jane Tanner sighting. I'll come back to this report later in this episode. Now, although the Smiths claimed to have seen a man carrying a small girl on the night of May 3, it wasn't until May 16, 13 days later, that Martin Smith made contact with Portuguese police. To me, it was and remains a somewhat curious delay. And it's curious to me because of this. Imagine you're in Praia da Luz. Maddie goes missing. The biggest news story in the world begins to explode around you, in that small town where you are staying for 5 more days before you leave to go home. You've seen someone carrying a girl on the night Maddie vanished, but you don't tell police until almost 2 weeks later. It does strike me as a bit odd. Here's what Pat Brown had to say about that. Now remember, Pat Brown is a profiler. Her job is to get inside the heads of people and develop theories based on evidence and human behaviour. I asked Pat, why so long for the Smiths to contact police?
It's one of those weird things where I think a lot of people don't necessarily put value on something they see, especially, you know, if they're busy doing other things and they've, you know, gone home, and it isn't until later that they start thinking, going, you know, what about that guy we saw? And, you know, if you look hard enough, there's things that always look funny. There's always little anomalies in life or things that don't, you know, you can't quite explain. So I personally don't have a doubt that the sighting is credible. What's the Smith sighting all about? Who is that guy taking a child toward the beach who's never been identified?
On the 9th of May, 6 days after Maddie vanished, the Smiths flew home to Ireland. In the days following their departure, the first suspect in the investigation emerged. His name was Robert Murat. Murat was a 33-year-old British-Portuguese man from England who was in Praia da Luz visiting his mother. Murat was staying at his mum's home, which was less than 100 metres from the McCann's apartment, 5A. The morning after Maddie's disappearance, Murat, who was bilingual, he approached Portuguese police and volunteered to work for them as a translator. His offer was accepted. But just 2 days later, on May 6, a British journalist working for UK tabloid The Sunday Mirror alerted police to what she claimed was Murat's strange behaviour. Here, that journalist, Laurie Campbell, is interviewed on Sky News on May 14, 2007. She said she'd felt suspicious about Murat's intentions, that she'd contacted her news desk back in London, and that they had encouraged her to talk with local police.
He was hanging around the scene an awful lot. He was asking us questions about what was going on in the investigation, maybe trying to find out what we knew.
Laurie Campbell's observations, which were later proven completely unfounded, quickly turned Robert Murat's life into a nightmare. Following Laurie Campbell's intervention, Gonzalo Amaral, the lead detective on the case, and his team of investigators began to take a closer look at Murat. A search warrant on Murat's mother's home was issued, but before the warrant was executed, Amaral wanted Jane Tanner to get a good look at Murat. He wanted Jane to confirm if Murat bore any similarity to the man she said she saw on the night of May 3. Police officers picked Jane Tanner up and sat her in an unmarked police vehicle with dark tinted windows. The vehicle parked up at the exact location where Jane Tanner said she was on the night of May 3 when she spotted the alleged abductor carrying a child. Robert Murat had no idea what was going on, that he was the subject of a covert ID check. Escorted by plainclothes cops, he walked past the vehicle, following the route Jane indicated the abductor had walked. Jane Tanner is adamant, wrote Gonzalo Amaral in his book. From the way he walks and moves, it was Robert Murat who she saw that night. Murat would of course be later proven completely innocent and to have played no part in Maddie's disappearance. Over many months, he was thoroughly investigated by Portuguese police and forensic experts. In 2008, Murat launched one of the largest libel claims in the history of British media, suing 11 newspapers and one television network for wrongly implicating him in Maddie's disappearance. He would be awarded hundreds of thousands of pounds in damages. In 2013, Robert Murat told UK broadcaster 5 News that despite being cleared of any involvement, it has been difficult, if not impossible, to live a normal life.
I've tried to move on and my family's tried to move on, but it's always something that I'm linked to. Whenever there's anything that's new, my name gets mentioned in it.
Murat's publicist, an extremely influential media man named Max Clifford, who is now dead, did tell Sky News in Britain why the massive libel payout to Murat was absolutely justified. Max Clifford was at one time the go-to PR man for celebrities, sports stars and politicians who had found themselves engulfed in a scandal. Clifford was also the agent who could fetch the biggest tabloid paydays for people who had scandalous stories to tell.
Well, he suffered months of being attacked and all kinds of things being written about him, the police had confiscated his computer and there were images of child pornography, totally untrue. Those kind of things that were thrown at him over a long period of time. Don't forget that he was attacked by the British media as soon as his status, his Arguido status, was put in place, and the McCanns followed some time afterwards. So his attacks went on even longer, and were in many ways even more vicious and nasty than the McCanns suffered.
Here's one thing to note about the Jane Tanner sighting. The eFit picture that she produced with police artists. The sketch showed a dark-haired man holding a child. But the man had no face. Instead, the suspect was given a blank, white, egg-shaped face with no eyes, no nose, no mouth, no facial features. After the police car walked by, Murat was named an Arguido, a formal suspect. Detectives swooped on Murat's mother's house, looking for clues. In the days that followed the Murat raid, three members of the Tapas Seven, Fiona Payne, Russell O'Brien, and Rachel Oldfield, all went to the police. The trio all told detectives they now remembered Robert Murat hanging around the Ocean Club Resort on the night of May 3, just after Kate had reported Maddie was gone. Fiona Payne, wife of David Payne, told police that after seeing Robert Murat on a Sky News bulletin, where his Arguido status was being reported, that she recognised him. Fiona said she saw a man she believed was Murat at about 10:40 p.m. next to the door of the McCann apartment in the company of police who were on the scene. Rachel Oldfield, wife of Matthew Oldfield, the member of the Tapas 7 who entered apartment 5A at 9:30 p.m. the night Maddie vanished, she told police she saw a man she believed to be Murat at about 11:30 p.m. between apartments 5B and 5D. Russell O'Brien, partner of Jane Tanner, gave a similar account. He told police he saw a man he believed was Murat in front of the McCann's apartment on the night of May 3. But all this information clashed with Murat's account. He fiercely denied all allegations he was anywhere near apartment 5A on the night of May 3. He told police he was home all night with his mother and that he had only found out the tragic news Maddie was missing the next morning on May 4. In this 2007 interview on Sky News, Murat's aunt Sally Everly denied Robert Murat was out searching the streets of Praia da Luz on the night Maddie vanished.
All the people that know Robert that were out on that night, that own bars, restaurants, businesses, that closed them all up to go and search for Madeline, were interviewed and questioned by the police, and they've all didn't see him. Of course they didn't see him. He wasn't there. But three complete strangers who have never met him before say that they saw him in the dark. I can't understand that.
Martin Brunt, who was Sky's main man on the ground in Praia da Luz, then asked Sally Everly a follow-up question.
And those three people are?
The friends of the McCanns.
They say every action has a reaction. And it was Robert Murat being named an Arguido that would bring the Smith family and their sighting into the Madeline McCann case. Martin Smith owned his holiday apartment in Praia da Luz. As a regular visitor, he had seen and met Murat around the sleepy seaside town on previous trips to Portugal. With Murat's face now splashed across TV screens and newspapers as a potential suspect, Martin Smith reconsidered what and who he had seen on the night of May 3. Troubled, Martin Smith contacted police on May 16 and told them about the man his family had seen carrying a child towards the beach that night. He told police the man he had seen was not Robert Murat. In secret, Portuguese police arranged for the Smiths to be brought from Ireland to Portimão for questioning. Once there, on May 26, Martin Smith, his son Peter, and his 12-year-old daughter named Aoife all gave official police statements. There were similarities in all three statements. On that narrow road heading towards the beach, walked a Caucasian brown-haired man, about 170 to 180 centimetres tall. He carried a small sandy-haired girl, probably aged 3 to 4, who appeared motionless and sleeping. The girl was wearing lightly coloured pyjamas, similar to the type Madeline wore to bed on the night she vanished. They weren't certain, but the girl may have been barefooted. Martin and Peter Smith both said, having seen photographs and TV images of Madeline, it could have been Maddie being carried in that man's arms. According to police records, Aoife said she was 60% certain the girl was Madeline. And with that, the Smiths returned to Ireland. It would be almost another 4 months before the Smith family would dramatically re-enter the case.
Both parents of Madeline McCann are now considered formal suspects by the Portuguese police authorities. Jerry McCann, when he left his late-night questioning, declared in the early hours of the morning that he too had been categorised as an arguido, a formal suspect, by police.
On the 8th of September, Britain's Sky News reported a sensational and unexpected development in the case from outside the Portimao police station.
This is a dramatic turnaround from the last 4 months where they were considered as the victims of an appalling crime. Now the McCanns are clearly being considered by police detectives here as potential suspects in the disappearance, perhaps even death, of their own daughter.
On September 9, 2007, after being declared arguidos, the McCanns flew out of Portugal and back to England. The EasyJet flight landed at East Midlands Airport in Derby. Media was waiting. Cameras filmed the McCanns disembarking the jet, walking down steps that led from the plane to the runway. Jerry carried his 2-year-old son, Sean. Sean is fast asleep, both arms hanging limp by his side, his blonde mop nestled contentedly into his dad's neck and left shoulder. Later that day, Martin Smith was at his home in Drogheda, Ireland, some 350 kilometres away from East Midlands Airport. On the 10 p.m. BBC News, he watched footage of Jerry carrying Sean off the plane. Seeing that footage would prompt Martin Smith to pick up the phone 11 days later and contact police. A police officer who took the call said Martin Smith told him, "It was like watching an action replay of the night he saw the male carrying the child back in Portugal." Alerts were sent to Portuguese detectives. Plans are discussed to bring the Smiths back to Portugal for more statements, and possibly even a reconstruction. But on October 2, Gonzalo Amaral was abruptly removed from the investigation after he was quoted by a journalist criticising British police involvement in the case. In the story, Amaral accused British police of only following up the leads that Kate and Jerry wanted followed up. Immediately, in what was already becoming an increasingly politicised case, involving the highest officers in the British and Portuguese governments, Amaral's superiors dump him from the investigation. Now there's a change of plan. Instead of the Smiths coming back to Portugal, 7 questions are sent to Irish police to ask Martin Smith on behalf of Portuguese detectives, who are now operating under a new head investigator, Paulo Rebelo, an assistant national police director. One of those questions given to Irish police for Mr. Smith states, "Was it really Jerry McCann? Is he sure of this fact?" There's a long delay, and it's not until February 2008, 5 months after the EasyJet plane footage aired on BBC, that an Irish police officer, Sergeant Liam Hogan, visits Martin Smith. Martin Smith reiterates his earlier statement, but this time adds, "I would be 60 to 80% sure that it was Jerry McCann that I met that night carrying a child." He bases this calculation on the way Jerry moved and held Sean as he descended down the stairs from the jet. Irish cop Liam Hogan writes a supporting note to sit alongside Martin Smith's statement, which then gets sent across to Portugal. Sergeant Hogan writes that Martin Smith has rejected all approaches by British tabloids. He adds Martin Smith is known locally and is a very decent person. Sergeant Hogan also states that private detectives hired by the McCanns have made contact with Martin Smith and are keen to visit the family to produce EFIT sketches. So let's stop here for a minute, because that's a lot of information and there's a few things worth noting. The months-long delay in getting Martin Smith's follow-up statement, it seems inexplicably long, considering the gravity of the situation. And this statement, when he eventually gives it, well, it's pretty heavy. Now, when Martin Smith, his son Peter, and daughter Aoife gave statements, all three of them said they would not be able to recognize the man they saw on the night of May 3 if he appeared in a lineup or they were shown a photo. But now Martin Smith is 60 to 80% certain. Has he inadvertently been influenced by the saturation media coverage showing the faces of Jerry and Kate McCann? After watching Jerry exit the plane and walk down the stairs, it took 11 days for Martin Smith to call police and tell them he thought the man he saw looked a lot like Jerry. 11 days. It's curious. It seems a long time to wait. The other real important thing to note here is Sergeant Liam Hogan writing that private detectives working for the McCanns intend to visit the Smiths to produce E-Fit sketches. But before we untangle that part of the story, let's look at the other big issue about the Smith sighting and what Martin Smith is claiming. On some level, Martin Smith being 60 to 80% certain he saw a man that looked a lot like Jerry McCann literally did not add up. The Smith sighting occurred at 10 p.m, which, remember, is about the time Kate McCann came running out of apartment 5A screaming Maddie was gone. And at that time, 10 p.m, Jerry was at the tapas bar. The testimonies of seven people, the tapas seven, would all, in unison, corroborate that. If Jerry was at the tapas bar, he couldn't be the man the Smith family saw. It was impossible, wasn't it? The Portuguese police seemed to think so. After shelving their investigation in July 2008, with no Maddie, no body, no arrests, and few signs of locating an abductor, they produced a closing 57-page report. The lengthy document summarized their 14-month investigation. The report stated clearly that Jerry McCann was sitting at the table in the tapas restaurant at the time of the Smith sighting. It seemed clear-cut. But despite the police report, criminal profiler Pat Brown claims nothing is certain. Gonzalo Amaral, too, has often expressed concern over parts and the robustness of the May 3 timeline that was told to police.
As far as the timetable is questionable, and that's the whole issue about the thing. We actually don't know exactly when Kate got there. We don't know exactly if Jerry was there.
Pat Brown is basically asking this question. How do we know that it was 10 p.m. when Kate found Maddie was gone and raised the alarm? Well, I guess we know that because Kate said it. Jerry also said it. And the members of the Tapas 7 all said it. And the weight of all those accounts was solid and good enough for the Portuguese police. Yet there were other witness statements given by a waiter and a kitchen hand who were working in the tapas bar that night, where the McCanns and friends were dining, which didn't necessarily sync up with the Tapas 7 timelines. For instance, when interviewed by police on May 4, Starikova Vitorino, a Russian kitchen hand, said a man who she believed to be Jerry McCann left the dinner table for about 30 minutes on the night Maddie vanished. And a waiter at the tapas bar, Joaquin Batista, he told police a man, he wasn't sure who, left the table where the McCanns and the Tapas 7 were eating for about 30 minutes. Batista said shortly after the man returned, everyone left the table because a girl had disappeared. It's possible that man was Russell O'Brien, who said he stayed for some time with his daughter while checking up on her. Or was it someone else in the Tapas 7 group? I need you to now think back to episode 2, where we played some audio from the made-for-TV reconstruction that the McCanns and the Tapas 7 did for British broadcaster Channel 4. The 2009 show was called Madeline Was Here. At one point, while discussing where Jerry was talking with Jez Wilkins after making his crucial check on Maddie at 9:10 p.m., Jane Tanner seems to indicate Jerry was away from the table for longer than a couple of minutes.
Because Kate had been moaning that you'd been gone a long time watching the football.
I'm almost certain that when I came.
One thing the Portuguese police lamented was that an official reconstruction of events never occurred. As you yourself will have found, having listened to episodes 1 and 2, there were so many moving parts and timelines on the night of May 3, leading up to Madeline's disappearance. It's a web of confusion. Portuguese police tried and failed to convince the Tapas 7 to take part in a reconstruction. The 57-page police report, which summarised the investigation, said a reconstruction could have clarified extremely important details about the group's timelines and movements on May 3.
Well, I think this is the sort of work that, you know, really needs to be done and should have been done. I think that there are always inconsistencies with eyewitnesses and witness statements. You know, you have to accept that. If you get 10 people looking at the same event and took 10 statements, you'd have a middle ground of, you know, 80-85% of what they say where they're consistent, but at the margins there would be differences. And you have to expect that, you have to accept that, and sometimes your job is to iron your way through those and find out, you know, what the most likely actual situation was. I know that the accounts and the timings and the kind of the various statements that were taken immediately after Madeline was reported missing and statements that have subsequently been taken, there is a degree of variation between what individuals say and also what the whole group says and looking across between the individuals. That's the sort of analytical work that I think, you know, would have been one of the early, or should have been one of the early pieces of work in the review. I think actually that's probably also the reason that the PJ in Portugal wanted to stage a reconstruction.
Once again, that's Colin Sutton, a former homicide detective for the London Metropolitan Police. Whenever Colin or anyone speaks about the PJ, that's the Polícia Judiciária, the name of Portugal's police force. Now, Colin told me, having looked at some of the witness statements, that timelines at some points of the evening seemed, and I quote, pretty tight. Reconstructions using actual witnesses. They allow police to put people's accounts under pressure. They push and prod to see what comes out, if something breaks or holds fast together.
The physical reconstruction with all the people involved is a good way of ironing out these variances between what people have said, because you can kind of physically demonstrate that you're in a situation where that and that cannot be right. They cannot exist together. So which one was it? And try to, you know, try to work that out. And I think if that were done, then we were to have a much clearer and more solid picture of the timeline of what went on, then it would be easier to make a judgment about when an abduction could have taken place and possibly even how it could have taken place, given the time frame that we were working with.
But let's come back to the Smiths, and in particular, the two EFITs they produced. Remember, at the start of this episode, the EFITs were suddenly released to the public in October 2013 on the BBC. The EFITs, it turned out, had been produced by a team of private detectives working for the McCanns, completely separate to the official police investigation. The private detectives were working for a firm called Oakley International. They travelled to Drogheda, Ireland in August 2008 to speak with the Smiths. Codenamed Operation Omega, the team took statements and created the EFITs. These assets form part of a report which was given to the McCanns and their advisors in November 2008. The McCann team decided that because the report was hypercritical of people involved in the investigation, releasing it could be distracting and damaging to the search for Maddie, according to a source quoted in British newspaper The Sunday Times. The dossier apparently highlighted the Smith sighting as a credible lead, and it questioned Jane Tanner's evidence. There appeared to have been some delay in giving these EFITs to Portuguese and British police. It wasn't until sometime later, but certainly by October 2009, almost 1 year later, that police became aware of the EFITs. But even then, It wasn't until October 2013, an additional 4 years later, that the efforts were eventually shown to the public, and the Smith sighting was then proclaimed as vitally significant by Scotland Yard. This chain of events to me is one of the most fascinating and baffling elements of the McCann case. Why did those efforts take so long to reach police? And why did British police wait until October 2013 before they showed them to the public? Making this podcast, I was in brief communication with one of the private detectives who was part of the Operation Omega team, working for Oakley International and the McCanns. All of the Operation Omega team were forced to sign non-disclosure agreements by the McCann team. They've been threatened with legal action if they ever make public the contents of the dossier they compiled for the McCanns. Initially, that person appeared open to being interviewed, maybe as an anonymous source. I was pretty excited by this. I was very keen to learn more about the Operation Omega report and what insights and intel they had compiled, especially from the Smith family. That person requested I send my questions in advance. And that's where I hit a dead end. I sent 4 starter questions. I asked about the team's impressions of the Smith family, why they found the Smith sighting credible and the Tanner sighting less important. I also asked why the report and all its contents was not made public, and how Scotland Yard eventually gained access to it. I got a reply. "Yours are sensible questions," they wrote. I was told the interview was off, and I quote, "There was every opportunity of upsetting the McCann's lawyers. I have no desire to end up in court." I've also been told by another source, close to Operation Omega, that all operatives have sometimes been reminded of their NDA obligations at various times by Carter Ruck, the fearsome London legal firm favoured by the McCanns to fight their libel battles. British journalist Sonia Poulton spoke to me about Carter Ruck and their impact in the UK media environment.
"People call it, be careful or you'll get rucked. And that's how my colleagues talk about it. Carter Ruck has a fair degree of influence. In fact, indeed, I think you'll find they're probably now the number one libel lawyer in the UK, due in no small part to all of the work that they've done on the Madeleine McCann case."
In May 2011, 4 years after Maddie vanished, Scotland Yard launched Operation Grange. Operation Grange had been set up to review and investigate Maddie's disappearance. And here's something to think about in relation to Scotland Yard, Operation Grange, and those two Smith efforts. Despite Scotland Yard sending their own detectives to Drogheda to speak with the Smiths and gather their own intel, Scotland Yard ended up using the exact efforts which had been drawn up by the Operation Omega team. In short, the UK's largest police force trusted the Smiths' efforts and the timing of their sighting enough to go public with them in October 2013. What is still unknown is who is the man carrying the small, motionless girl. Here's criminal profiler Pat Brown with some more thoughts on the Smith sighting and the Tanner sighting.
"This is the number one issue about the whole case, and I've stuck by this for years, and I stand by it today. There were two people cited, the McCanns, if their child was kidnapped, have heard two things. It could be there was one man seen at the Tanner sighting, and then there's a Smith sighting. Both of them are possible. Both of them could have been the guy carrying away their child. In other words, at least a 50-50 chance that the Smith sighting is a real sighting. At least a 50-50 chance."
Pat Brown has often told me to look at how the McCanns reacted to the Smith sighting. Remember, those two Smith efforts came into the possession of the McCann team in late 2008. On the official Find Madeleine website, little prominence is given to the Smith efforts, despite Operation Grange declaring them vitally significant. Instead, Jane Tanner's effort, the man with no face, is positioned on the website's homepage. In Kate McCann's book, Madeleine, the Smith sighting is included in a chapter called Key Sightings. That section details a total of 6 men, the Tanner sighting, the Smith sighting, and four other men who were spotted around the Ocean Club Resort and deemed to be of interest. Of those six men, the only man without an associated artist sketch in the book is the Smith sighting. In the next episode of Maddie.
There's no blood, there's no trauma there. That was just what we call the sense of death.
A dramatic turning point in the case. The UK's top search expert is brought to Portugal to explore the possibility that Maddie is dead. Two dogs trained to detect dead bodies and human blood search the McCann's apartment, a rental car, and the surrounding area. The dogs make a number of alerts, and soon after, Portuguese police declare the McCanns are Guidos. The Maddie podcast is reported, written, and narrated by me, Mark Salnoconoco. Dan McHugh is our producer and sound designer. Simon King is our editorial advisor and editor. You can read more about this case and the podcast and see interactive graphics and maps on 9.com.au.